It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's a 12-year difference in the life expectancy for people in two different zip codes in Milwaukee. We'll find out how poverty impacts people throughout their lives. First, it's time for our weekly look at national politics. This week, a backlash over presidential retweets, a run-up to a contested U.S. Senate seat in Alabama, and a sting operation targeting the Washington Post that backfired. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She's here to get us up to speed on these stories and more. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this attempted sting operation at the Washington Post. This came out yesterday. It gets a little complicated. Can you talk us through the story of Jamie Phillips, who came to the Washington Post with claiming she had allegations against Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore?
Sure. Well, I mean, the Washington Post obviously published its big explosive story saying that there were women who accused Roy Moore of pursuing them when they were teenagers and he was an adult. And the Moore campaign has really gone after these allegations, basically saying they're fake news. It's part of this liberal media crusade to get him. And there's been this attempt that it seemed on the right to sort of disprove the allegations and to show that it's fake news, basically. And so we saw the behind the scenes of this when Project Veritas, which is run by James O'Keefe, who's known for doctoring videos and running these conservative stings, tried to do this to the Washington Post. He sent one of his operatives, a woman named Jamie Phillips, to go to the Washington Post, claim that Roy Moore impregnated her and tried to get her to have an abortion when she was younger, to try to get the Washington Post to publish this fake news, to basically show the Washington Post was publishing any dirt, even if it wasn't true. And it backfired. The Washington Post caught this woman. You know, it basically showed that the Washington Post, they have very good reporters there. They do their homework. And it made James O'Keefe and his operative look ridiculous, honestly.
And yeah, videos have come out. The Washington Post had secret videos of a reporter talking to Jamie Phillips, who was presumably secretly trying to video the reporter in question. And a lot of this showed a behind-the-scenes look at how people do journalism, trying to confirm stories that show up on their doorstep.
Exactly. This Jamie Phillips person came to them. She said she wanted to talk to them, and so they did some research on her. And one of their researchers at the Washington Post noticed that a woman who appeared to be the same woman had put up one of those GoFundMe pages saying, "Hey, I'm moving to New York to pursue my dream, to work, to expose the lies of the mainstream media." And this obviously raised some red flags for the people at the Washington Post. And so the reporter confronted Jamie about this and said, "You know, you don't seem to be who you say you are. Can you explain this to us?" And she had an excuse that she was going to work for the Daily Caller, which is a conservative publication, but it fell through. The Daily Caller said that they had never heard of someone by that name. There was no job offer ever for her. And her story just fell apart. But again, it showed that the Washington Post does its homework. They have very good journalists, and this conservative smear machine is trying to do what it can to undermine the mainstream media.
Is there any fallout here for Project Veritas, the group behind this? They've gotten funding from some donors, including just before his presidential campaign, I understand Donald Trump himself had made a donation.
Well, Donald Trump has shown, as I think we'll probably talk about more on this show, he does not really work to verify the news before he promotes it. So I don't think that this will necessarily change Donald Trump's view of the group's work. But, I mean, James O'Keefe has been discredited for a while. He is well known for doctoring videos and putting out things that portray his enemies in the worst light, whether or not it's true. So people have not been taking them seriously for quite a while, but I think this, in many ways, is the most damaging thing to him that's ever happened. But I think by now, everyone in the media knows to be incredibly skeptical of anything he claims or does. I mean, even after this, the Washington Post sent reporters up to O'Keefe's office to confront him about why he did this. And they had an exchange where they asked James O'Keefe some questions. He ignored them. And then he tried to ask the Washington Post reporter some questions. O'Keefe put out a video of this. Of course, he doctored it and edited it so that all of the Washington Post questions were not there, just making it look like they were running away from him. So it's typical of what he does.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post. She's the Washington bureau chief there, looking at some of the top news stories in national politics this week. Well, related back to that Roy Moore story, there is, of course, this Senate race in Alabama, the biggest election going on in a non-usual election time that's coming up in a couple of weeks. And you wrote recently about national Democrats and their support for Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate in Alabama, and kind of a hands-off strategy. What's going on?
Well, Alabama is obviously a tough place for a Democrat to win statewide. And I think most Democrats thought that they had no chance at this race until Roy Moore, who was very controversial, was named the GOP nominee. And so the question is, how do they help Democrat Doug Jones win there? He's a strong candidate. He is best known for being a U.S. attorney who prosecuted the KKK for bombing a black church, and he put the KKK members behind bars. So, you know, what should Democrats do? Give money, send people down there to campaign? And there are a lot of Democrats who are frustrated, saying it seems like the National Party isn't doing enough. They haven't sent him money. They haven't run ads. But I talked to Democrats down in Alabama who said that basically Jones is getting a lot of money. He has more money than Roy Moore does. And that the worst thing Democrats could do is have the National Party come in and run ads or do a big show of force, because frankly, Alabama voters don't really like National Democrats. And so Doug Jones is doing what he can to distance himself from National Democrats like, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and try to make it about local issues, state issues, and say, I'm different than the National Party. So basically, they need to be behind the scenes helping him with what he needs, but they can't be out there publicly giving him money and running ads.
Is this a general story for places where that national brand might not be big, whether that's a Democrat running in a Republican state or maybe a Republican running in a traditionally Democratic state?
Absolutely. I think you'll see a lot of Republicans running in districts where Donald Trump is not that popular, trying to distance themselves from Trump and say, look, you know, Trump's not my guy. Mitch McConnell, maybe not my guy either. I am focused more on local issues, and the current Republican Party is not what I like. I mean, Democrats have learned, on the Democratic side, they've really learned their lesson. You had the Georgia 6th Congressional District, where you had John Ossoff, who was sort of this national Democratic phenomenon, run against Karen Handel, who was a Republican. And national Democrats were excited about this race. It's a traditionally Republican seat. It was to replace Tom Price, who was a congressman there but became Health and Human Services Secretary. So it was a special election. Democrats said, we can get this seat. But ultimately, the National Party came in, and the Republicans in the district didn't like it, and it got too much attention, and Republicans ended up winning. And so that's what they don't want happening in Alabama.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post, about the top political stories of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow this sting targeting the Washington Post? What is your reaction to that story? Do you have thoughts on the biggest game in town as far as elections go right now, this Alabama Senate seat, Roy Moore, Doug Jones? What do you think of those candidates, how the national parties are in their own ways, in many ways, distancing themselves from those candidates? Coming up, we'll talk about the president, President Trump, referring again to Senator Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas at a ceremony honoring Native American veterans, the Navajo Code Talkers. We'll talk about those issues. You can share your thoughts now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our look at the top stories in national politics now with Amanda Turkle, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. President Trump getting a lot of reaction for, again, referring to Senator Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas during a ceremony honoring Navajo Code Talkers, veterans from World War II, and retweets of three anti-Islamic videos from the far-right group Britain First. Your reaction to that? Also, the story about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the argument over who gets to be the boss there. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. George is with us in Beaver Dam. George, hi.
Hi, Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I identify myself as kind of a moderate Republican, maybe a little bit Democrat. But anyways, the whole thing about this sting operation about Roy Moore just kind of bothers me. Isn't there some kind of crime these guys can be charged with for trying to, manipulate the media and everything else? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
George, thanks for the call. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. No money changed hands here, so I don't know if it's fraud or anything like that. Amanda, have you seen any talk of potential charges related to that?
I haven't in this one. I mean, James O'Keefe has faced charges in the past because he's broken in places, for example. But for this one so far, I haven't heard of that. It's more just sort of, I think, more of an embarrassment on what he was doing. But yes, charges against James O'Keefe on other things have been around. And, he is known for being not only unethical, but I think perhaps like crossing the line. So it'll be interesting to see if anything does come of that.
Thanks a lot for that call, George. Let's turn to a couple of controversial incidents from the president this week. At a ceremony yesterday honoring Navajo code talkers, World War II veterans, President Trump made a remark aimed at Senator Elizabeth Warren. Here's a listen.
You're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special.
The backstory there, referring to Senator Warren as Pocahontas, can you talk about the backstory there?
Sure. It relates to Warren's claim that she is of Native American ancestry. And, a lot of people raised questions about that. Warren said she couldn't necessarily prove it, but that was what was said in her family. And Donald Trump has found this absolutely hilarious and has nicknamed her Pocahontas and continues to call her that, even though many people pointed out that it's very offensive and it's racist. It was especially bad that he did it at a ceremony honoring Native American veterans to bring up this racial slur, something that didn't have to do at all with the bravery of these men. And it was also terrible, as many people pointed out, that the White House didn't see why it was bad that they did this event right in front of a portrait of Andrew Jackson, who was known as president for the forced removal of Native Americans and, known for sort of decimating the Native American population in this country. So it was pretty bad and offensive all around.
And here's the president of the Navajo Nation, Russell Begay, talking about this on MSNBC yesterday.
This is where we're honoring and respecting our veterans, especially our code talkers, and to put in a slur that has become racial, Pocahontas, didn't belong there. It was inappropriate, was not a time to do it, was not a place to do it. This was a time to lift up the veterans, especially the code talkers, and the contribution to this nation.
Let's bring on a caller on this now. We've got Charlie just dropped off the line in Milwaukee. I guess we won't go to him, but we'll talk to you again sometime. Charlie, I want to move on to another issue. We're going to get into this ceremony a little more tomorrow at 4:30. President Trump retweeted three videos from the account of Jada France and a leader of the group Britain First, variously described as far white, far right or white nationalist in Great Britain. Can you tell us what was in these videos he retweeted?
Sure. They were basically what he said they showed was Muslims committing acts of violence. And the videos had titles like Muslim migrant beats up Dutch boy on crutches, Muslim destroys a statue of Virgin Mary, and Islamist mob pushes teenage boy off roof and beats him to death. But, Trump had no idea if these videos were true, if they showed what he said they were. For example, one of the videos did not show a Muslim migrant at all, but it showed a teenage boy who was born in the Netherlands. There were incidents in Syria and Egypt without explaining the context of what was going on then. One happened, for example, in 2013, shortly after the military overthrew the country's first elected president. There was protests and violence there. It's not just random Muslim people beating up and committing violence, other, you know, committing violence against other people. And the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, was questioned about these videos. And she admitted that she didn't know if they were true, but she said that didn't matter because this sort of thing is happening. And that was Trump's point. And that's incredibly irresponsible. And she said the threat is real. The threat needs to be addressed. The threat has to be talked about. But she admitted that they didn't know if those videos themselves were real. I mean, that's like saying that putting up, I don't know, videos of some imaginary creature and saying, we don't know if they're real. But these pictures are real. But we you know, the threat's out there. So, you know, it was very racist. You know, the person who shared these videos, the leader of Britain First, Franson, has actually committed violence against Muslims. So this is, you know, it was sort of a low point, I think, for many people in Trump's tweets.
Let's go to a caller on this. Michelle is with us in Green Bay. Michelle, hi.
Yeah, hi. These videos are just appalling. I saw them when I first woke up. I'm a middle school teacher. I have Muslim students in my class. We spent time talking about this. The students are affected. This is a geopolitical issue, but it's also an issue for Americans and for children who are being raised in the Muslim faith in our communities. And it's just beyond belief what I see now compared to what I saw a couple of years ago, and how it's affecting people's lives. And I just don't even have words for it.
Michelle, thanks for the call. And there's been a lot of reaction, including from the office of the prime minister in England, saying Britain First, the group that had posted the video, seeks to divide communities in their use of hateful narratives. Went on to say it is wrong for the president to have done this. What's been the reaction like, Amanda?
I mean, the reaction has been incredibly negative. Obviously, there are members of Trump's base who, you know, believe these videos and think they're fine, which is part of why it's troubling that the president of the United States shares them. But, you know, as the caller mentioned, there are a lot of people out there who are Muslim or who maybe aren't Muslim, but who maybe have brown skin. And to see the president share videos like this that are old, that are unsubstantiated, that basically just show brown people being violent. And it sends a message to a lot of people that it basically sends a racist message to a lot of people out there who aren't white. And I think that's part of what was so upsetting. I mean, there was also national security experts who said that if you are trying to create anti-American hostility and create more unrest in the Middle East, what Trump is doing is a great way of doing that, because he's basically just painting all Muslims with a broad brush and saying they're all violent and, you know, America is against you. And that's what a lot of leaders have tried not to do, you know, have tried to say that, look, there's nothing wrong with the Muslim faith. There are extremists, as there are in every religion, but we have nothing against the Muslim faith. And Trump does not seem to be, you know, making that distinction.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about national politics with Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post. Bringing a call on the Code Talkers ceremony issue now. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi, great program. Thanks for taking my call. I think what your guest is saying, the word that she used, is troubling. I think as a Marine Corps veteran, I think that vets and Indian leaders need to call upon the president to apologize. I think where he missed the boat was that we respect and honor their Indian heritage, but they were there as Marines who had put their lives and safety on the line to protect and to save others' lives. And he had a wonderful opportunity in front of them to draw attention to what they have done and to honor their service. And that's been totally missed. And these men, these brave men, if you look at the ribbons on their chest, these are quite decorated men. There aren't many of them left. And so I was actually quite saddened to see all of this kind of play out. And I'm quite disappointed in Paul Ryan and the Republican leadership for not having stepped up and said, you know, the president needs to apologize. No one has asked him to apologize. I mean, and I'm not going to go on and on about, you know, what he has said and done to women, which that's a whole nother subject. But, I mean, we need to call upon him to say, it's time for you to issue an apology to these men.
Paul, thanks for the call. I want to jump in and give our guest a chance to respond. Have there been calls from fellow Republicans on this, Amanda?
Well, Paul Ryan does not usually call out Donald Trump as forcefully as many people, including within the Republican Party, would like him to. Senator John McCain, who's obviously a veteran and a war hero, did say, he said that politicizing these genuine American heroes is an insult to their sacrifice. And I mean, Trump, you know, to get to your caller's point, Trump, when it comes to veterans, likes to say that he cares about veterans, he cares about the military more than everyone else. But, you know, he has done many things that other presidents wouldn't even dream of, you know, going after John McCain during the campaign and saying that he's not a hero because he was captured as a prisoner of war, and that, you know, Donald Trump likes people who weren't captured. I mean, he didn't even serve in the military. You know, going after Khazir Khan, the Gold Star father whose son died while serving the country, and attacking him and attacking his Muslim faith. So, you know, I don't think we will see Trump apologize. I think this is, you know, sort of what he does.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Amanda, the big push on Capitol Hill is for the tax overhaul plan. Do these kind of comments and retweets and whatnot distract from that big policy issue?
Oh, absolutely. Republicans on Capitol Hill do not enjoy all of this. They don't enjoy when reporters go up to Capitol Hill and ask them if they can respond to Trump's latest tweet. They'd much rather be talking about taxes. Yes, the tax fight is still going on, and right now it looks like Republican senators are on their way to passing it. And I think a lot of Republicans wish Trump perhaps had done a little bit more, as presidents have in the past. You know, they are out there with the bully pulpit. He could be convincing reluctant senators to sign on by promising them certain things. And so far, Trump hasn't really played that role quite as much as past presidents.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Turkel. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She joined us for a weekly roundup of national politics. First, in the United States as a whole, a quarter of children under five are living in poverty. In Milwaukee, the numbers are worse. More than 40% of children under 18 fall below the poverty line. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have named the conditions of poverty as a risk factor for trauma, which means that poverty in early life can have a lifelong impact. Bevin Baker is a commissioner of health for the city of Milwaukee. He recently took part in a panel discussion at Marquette University that focused on the connection between poverty and childhood trauma. Commissioner Baker, welcome back to Central Time.
So happy to be here with you.
Now, how does poverty act as a form of trauma?
Well, it underlies a significant event in one's life, and it can be a driver. It can be a barrier to people and families thriving in our community. It really undermines and determines some key things in our lives, whether we have food security, whether we have housing quality, whether we have good access to schools or jobs. So poverty is a major driver for the well-being of all who live in this great state of Wisconsin.
And how does it affect, let's start with kids before we look at the long-term impact of growing up in poverty. Can you talk about how poverty affects directly the lives of children?
Well, first and foremost, children need to feel safe, and and they sort of absorb everything like a sponge. You know, they're bright and they're curious, but they can feel stress, and that chronic stress that adults have, you know, it sort of impacts children, and doesn't give them a chance to really thrive in their lives, and it can really create anxiousness. It can create a feeling of stress that one can't turn off. It's a light that never goes off. And childhood trauma can really hurt foundational issues and growth for children. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think this is a major concern for us. Children living in these environments of chronic unmitigated stress are more likely to have some downstream traumatic events in life. They're more likely to need special help at schools. They're more likely to be engaged in activities that might lead to either low functioning or even violence, for that matter.
And this can turn up in life expectancy. You were at a conference lately where people talked about the differences in something as simple as lifespan for people growing up in a lower income and growing up in poverty or a higher income neighborhood. Can you talk about the difference that can make?
Well, it's a huge difference, and we've been able to look at two zip codes here in our city of Milwaukee, and the difference of growing up in one of these two zip codes where chronic poverty is in one and there's a wealthier community in the other is 12 years. It's about 4,380 days difference of life expectancy. So, and I think that's just wrong. No one should have their life expectancy determined just by their zip code. But because of poverty indicators in this one zip code, you can expect to live 12 years less.
And we're talking two zip codes just basically down the road from each other, right?
Down the road from each other. Geographically, one would be able to get in their car and drive there in a matter of minutes, but it's a world of difference and a world of life expectancy. 12 years, nearly 4,400 days.
Let's talk about some of the other outcomes of poverty when it comes to things like educational success and incarceration rates.
Well, there's great data out there to suggest that, you know, the low educational attainment and poverty as a barrier can lead to less economic security throughout the lifespan of an individual. And that's just tough. There's, you know, imagine always having to climb uphill. And when you get uphill, you have to go back down again. You don't get to stay at a level where you can have economic security. And in terms of a life where crime and or violence or the prison system intersects, there are poverty indicators. And the things that we look at, those barriers actually somehow terminate into incarceration. And Wisconsin leads in that regard when we stratify for some of the poverty indicators. And we need to do better in that regard.
This is kind of a different way of thinking, because we might think poverty is over here. It's an economic problem. Health and medicine over here, that's a medical problem. We don't always think of the overlap. Are we starting to change the way we think?
We're changing the way we think, and I think we're utilizing good population health and public health metrics. Now, we have something called our Milwaukee Elevate. It's our 5-year community health improvement plan. And what we're doing there is saying we want to address these issues that are not typical. We want to address economic security. We want to address fairness and inclusivity in our society, and we really want to look at mental health. These are the things that our community is saying that we need to look at, but it's also what researchers are saying that we need to look at to make certain that we have the goal of becoming a trauma-informed city and hopefully a trauma-informed state, so everyone has an equal opportunity to thrive and poverty would not be a major barrier.
We're talking to Bevin Baker, Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee, about the links between poverty, trauma, and health. And Bevin, let's follow up on what you were just talking about there. Trauma-informed care is a phrase I've heard a lot. What does it mean to be thinking in a trauma-informed way about citizens' health?
Well, this means that government and community-based agencies are trained better to understand the impact of trauma has on their particular community. It means that we're better able to serve individuals who have experienced trauma. It means that you know what's out there in the community and you're going to do a better job. Just imagine if you went to your mechanic and he had no clue about the type of car that you were driving and no clue about how that car functions. We want to be informed so when someone comes in for care that we can impact their outcomes. And that's what being a trauma-informed city and a state means, that we understand, we cover the waterfront, and we're experienced in being able to meet the needs of anyone who would come through our doors.
On a practical level, who's the we here? Who needs training? Who needs to maybe change the mindset in interacting with the public?
Well, a long time ago, I used to think it was just your family practice doc. But I think it's now anyone who interacts with anyone in the public health systems. If you go to get your eyes checked, or if you go to get just a wellness check, or if you go to do anything where you're impacting your life by a caregiver, they need to be trauma-informed. They need to get trained so they can understand the symptoms, the signals, and any type of indicator that suggests that trauma and stress have impacted your life. So the we is everyone. The we could be your daycare. It could be just looking at how your child is responding. The daycare worker could say, you know, we know Johnny or Jane has been a little, you know, not themselves these last couple of weeks. Is there anything going on? Just making certain that everyone has their antenna up. So the we is all of us, and all of us can know that there are individuals who have a bad day, but everyone should be prepared to do something about it, to intervene, and to make certain that we can help people where they are.
Is the criminal justice system part of that story, from police to courtrooms and beyond?
I think that they are. I think that they have to make certain that safe and a reliable community is a part of it. I think that there's a lot of work to be done in that area, and I think that our law enforcement and our criminal justice system are moving in that direction. But sometimes it's hard to change overnight. This is not going to happen immediately, but it won't happen unless we get out the gate and start doing this. I think the key thing to remember here is that most needed answers and solutions are economic. We know that poverty is a driver, and if we can get jobs, if we can get economic development, then I think the criminal justice system becomes a long-term issue, but not an immediate-term solution. And I think that this is what we got to do to make certain that economic indicators are put on the table so that poverty won't drive us to incarceration.
It seems like the biggest problem here is a vicious cycle. If a generation is growing up in poverty, and we're finding that means their education is going to suffer for that, they're going to be more likely to be incarcerated, less likely to get jobs, then that means we're raising a new generation to live in poverty and so on down the road. How do you break that?
Well, I think we break that by going far upstream from where we currently are. And I think that we know that there are drivers for poverty. There are social and economic determinants that impact our whole lives, whether that be the housing, the transportation, or the education. But we have to go upstream. And that's what we're talking about. Impacting families, impacting children very early in life, looking at things like, you know, adverse childhood experiences, so that before individuals get to adulthood, that we've always already addressed those key concerns. So we have to go far upstream. You don't wait until the disease shows up to begin to think about prevention.
Now, I've heard trauma-informed care as a phrase more and more. I've heard it from Democrats and Republicans, people at the state and local levels. I know the First Lady of Wisconsin, Tonette Walker, has been talking about it. How do you make sure that something's actually done with that and it's not just a buzzword that we forget about in a year or two?
Well, I think that, and I appreciate the work of First Lady Walker. I think she's done a great job of raising awareness. I think what you're beginning to see at the federal level is that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and the payer systems are going to say, you need to make certain that this is a part of your delivery of services. I think you have to, government needs to make certain that we don't pay providers who aren't looking at trauma-informed care as a key component of their health service delivery. So we need to have reimbursement follow action, and I think that's what we're going to see. So policy change is coming, but it's great to have awareness at the level of the First Lady, to have legislators talking about it, but I think we have to have payment schemes match our actions, and that is on the way. And I think you're going to see more of that with behavioral health being reimbursed along the way for those who understand and have been trained in trauma-informed care.
We'll leave it there for now. Commissioner Baker, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. So happy to have you, and thank you for getting the word out to Wisconsin residents.
Bevin Baker is Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about high poverty rates in some of Milwaukee's neighborhoods and how they can lead to trauma symptoms in children and adults. First, the field of genetics has advanced a lot in the last couple of decades, and that's led to cheaper and cheaper tests to look for disease risks and to map out our personal genealogy and ancestry. Led by companies like 23andMe and Ancestry, the market for direct-to-consumer genetic tests is growing. Here's an ad for the Ancestry DNA service.
I wanted to know who I am and where I came from. I did my Ancestry DNA, and I couldn't wait to get my pie chart. The most shocking result was that I'm 26% Native American. I had no idea. Just to know this is what I'm made of, this is where my ancestors came from, and I absolutely want to know more about my Native American heritage.
Sounds fun, but our next guest says we should think about the risks of sharing our personal genetic info. Jason Fletcher is a professor in the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs and the Department of Sociology. His book is called The Genome Factor. It looks at the latest discoveries in genomics and where they fit into the social sciences. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Let's start with the positives here. There are a lot of breakthroughs and discoveries in the field of genetics. How are they improving our lives and our care?
I think they have a lot of potential to improve our lives and our care. Part of it is under what many listeners might have heard of as precision medicine, tailoring interventions, medications based on individuals' genetic variants. Some treatments work really well for some people based on what genetic code they have, and maybe less well on others. So that type of precision could increase outcomes for all kinds of illness outcomes.
In our daily lives, though, there's one decision we have to make, whether or not to do these DNA home testing kits for our genealogy, to look at our medical risks. What kind of things should we be thinking about before we sign ourselves up?
I think the main one is that it's relatively a permanent decision. It's not something that's very easily taken back. This is something about you that you, these letters in your genome that you would receive from 23andMe or a different company, those are the same letters you had as an embryo. They're the same letters you're going to have throughout your whole life. So once you know them, in particular, once other people know them, they know something permanent about you. So it really is a once-in-a-lifetime type decision when you choose to do it, and you're making choices for both you and your relatives.
Right, because if you know something about me, you know something about people who are my siblings, parents, children.
That's right. And in particular, if you find, you know, lurking in your genetic code, devastating illnesses that haven't expressed themselves. Alzheimer's disease would be an example. That's something that you could diagnose when you're 0 days old, just born, that you live with your whole life. And it also tells you if you have, if you carry these letters in your genetic code that increase your risk for Alzheimer's disease, you got them from somewhere, you got them from your parents, and you likely share similar risk with your brothers and sisters, and you're likely will pass that risk on to your children. So when you donate your information, you're donating many, many other people's information.
So I might think if I did this and mailed my saliva in, no big deal. This is between me and the nice folks at the company that I'm paying some money to get this information. If I haven't read the terms that go along with it, what really happens? What kind of safety, security do I have with how that info is managed?
That's what's the great unknown, and that's why this being an irreversible decision is so important, because you can maybe reflect back on a couple months ago on the very large data breach on all our credit card reports that was secure information, and all of a sudden, you know, many, many hundreds of, or more than 100 million people's social security numbers and so on were released. You might imagine that one data hack like this in the future, again, because this is permanent information about yourself, could happen, and therefore you might second guess your original decisions to contribute your saliva.
That's an illegal hack. Can these companies do things with this information either for commercial gain or for research purposes?
Exactly right. That's part of the point. And that might not get back to you as a person. So you might not be so worried about your own privacy. But you should realize that for many of these companies, when you donate your DNA information, you're oftentimes relinquishing that information in the purpose of science. And that has a lot of upsides that would potentially lead to new discoveries. But it's just something you should keep in mind as you're potentially making that choice.
Suppose somebody has my genetic information. So what? They can't open a credit card account with my DNA. What kind of negative impacts could that have on me in the future?
This is where it really depends on what sort of laws we're going to enact or continue. We have an act called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act from 2008, that says employers and health insurers cannot use that information. So those are two groups who are barred from using that information. That was almost overturned 8 months ago in the House of Representatives. So that's maybe fragile, but it also doesn't outline other groups who could use that information. Life insurance companies, for example, aren't directly barred from using information on your risk of Alzheimer's disease, for example, in providing policies for you.
Now, this week, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer called for the Federal Trade Commission to investigate these mail-in companies that we've seen the ads for, the genetic testing services, hoping to ensure that their privacy policies, he said, are clear, transparent, and fair to customers. What would you like to see happen there?
That's a great step. I don't have any real problem with that. I think it's really going forward as these companies and researchers and academic institutions use information to make predictions about our life outcomes that are important. That's everything from Alzheimer's disease to our weight over our life, to our risk of hospitalization, to our IQ and education. All that information is becoming more and more predictable from our genotype, from what we contribute to these companies. So we need to outline how that information can and cannot be used. Right now we have some narrow outlining of who cannot not use that information. And what you're describing sounds like a good step. It's not a full set of steps on who can and can't use that information and for what purposes they can and cannot be used.
Talking to Jason Fletcher from UW-Madison, author of the book The Genome Factor, looking at genetic testing and what it means for our lives, really. And Jason, let's talk about another angle we haven't gotten into yet. We go and get a test. We look at our medical risks. And sometimes a genetic medical risk is a great thing to know. It's 100% sure thing. Way more often, as I understand it, it's really a maybe. It's a low, it's a 1% difference. And that may stress us out a lot unnecessarily.
There's a lot of stresses we can learn from these genetic tests, all from the ones you're describing, which are humans have a hard time with small probability differences. If I tell you your risk of something really bad happening 20 years from now is a 1% increase based on your genotype, we have a hard time figuring out how to react to that. We also have a hard time figuring out how to react to news that's a little bit more devastating, which is that if you have two variants on a particular gene called APOE, that your lifetime risk of Alzheimer's is over 90%. You could know that when you're 15. And you add that to, do we have any treatments for you? Those are all issues to think about. So I certainly agree with there being a wide range of reactions to this type of information.
It seems like a pretty common story. We have a new technology. We do lots of stuff with it. Before we start thinking through the implications of it for things like ethics and privacy and safety, are we there again with genetic testing?
I think so. And the only thing that might be different this time is just a matter of degree, which is how fast this is moving. Every few months, there are new genetic discoveries that could be put in use that people might be interested in knowing about. And we just are way far ahead of the legislation and the rules that operate around these new technologies.
I don't know if you'll give a yes or no answer here, but presumably somebody listening now is thinking, yeah, maybe I'll do that test. Be cool to see where I came from, that sort of thing. What advice would you give them in making that decision?
I think ask other people the type of information, other people who've done the same thing, what type of information, maybe hear, think about their stories. Think about both the positive and the negative. Different companies give you different amounts, different types of information. 23andMe will give you, if you choose, risk of Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. You really have to think about whether you want to know that information. And there's a purely more recreational use, the ancestry-only type, that you might be very interested in that. So I think it's mostly thinking about the types of information you actually want and probably talking to other people who have already done it when making your choice.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what's one big story in genetics testing that we're not talking about?
I think one story that we will be talking about in the future is how we're going to allow this information to be used in selecting embryos in IVF, in vitro fertilization. All these genetic tests for disease and IQ, for that matter, and height and blue eyes, you can do that on embryos on a cell that's a day old and use that to select the what embryo you're going to implant for your pregnancy. There's no regulation on this. So any regulation would be a step forward. Or any thinking about what regulations we actually want is a step forward. So we're, in that sense, way behind.
A lot to think about. I'm sure we'll talk to you about these issues again, Jason. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Jason Fletcher. He's a professor in the UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of sociology. He's the author of the book The Genome Factor. We've been talking about genetic testing and some of the frontiers of genetic research and the potential implications when they come to sending in those tests. You can let us know what you've done if you've made this decision yourself. Email ideas@wpr.org and share your story, but not your genetic data, please. A reminder, this week is the 50th anniversary of the Beatles album, The Magical Mystery Tour. We're going to talk to a music writer about that album, how it was created, the influence it's had, its role in the Beatles pantheon, and more. And throughout the week, we're going to play tracks from that album, and we're asking what you think. A lot of people don't put this as their number one favorite Beatles album, including Albert, who wrote on the Central Time Facebook page, a good album, not a great one. I Am the Walrus is a great tune, but didn't need this album to make it great. It always seemed out of place to me. Sgt. Pepper and the White Album are more enjoyable to me. How about you? Are you a fan of Magical Mystery Tour? What is your favorite Beatles album? What is your all-time favorite Beatles song? And how did you discover the Beatles? Did you grow up with it? Did you grow up with it in your parents' collection, or are you discovering it, the Beatles, online now? You can email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. One of the songs, Strawberry Fields, here on Central Time.
Nothing is real. Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever.